I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We talk about polarization, political polarization in America. This hour, the Pew Research Center did a study not that long ago, and they found that Republicans and Democrats are further apart ideologically than at any point in recent history. If you are a Democrat, you express highly negative views of Republicans. If you're a Republican, highly negative views of Democrats. And polarization was also found in the personal lives and lifestyles of those who are on the left and those who are on the right. So why has partisan antipathy gone up so much? Why is it that if you're on the left, you tend to live in a certain part of the country? You live in an urban area. If you're on the right, you may tend to be in more of a not as close together part of America. And why has it become so difficult for us to talk to each other? Well, we're going to talk about it this hour. It's also going to be a forum that I'm moderating this coming Saturday, sponsored by the League of Women Voters, and we'll tell you more about that as we continue. We have two guests with us this hour who will offer very interesting perspectives. Marjorie Sproul joining us at the top of the hour. She teaches courses in women's history, Southern history, and recent American history at the University of South Carolina. She is the author of Divided We Stand, the Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics. She is joining us, and she will talk about the fact that we can't fully understand current American politics and social policies without appreciating all the events that divided American women in the 1970s and the subsequent polarization of American politics at large. Later in the hour, Mark Schmidt will join us, director of the Program on Political Reform at New America. He's written extensively on this topic, has a lot of experience in government. He was a speechwriter and policy director for Senator Bill Bradley, and he served as a senior advisor on Bradley's 2000 presidential campaign. We'll be welcoming phone calls all hour. We're talking about the divide, the forms that it takes, how it can be mended will be part of the conversation as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at KDunn Show. Professor Marjorie Sproul, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, let's go back to the 1970s and your book that looks at women's issues in politics up through the 2016 presidential election. Is it fair to say that some of the great divide we're experiencing now was a result of the divide over women's role and women's issues in the 70s?
That is essentially the main point of the book, that a lot of what we're seeing now dates back to events that took place during the 70s. And I argue that the political culture that we have now was fully in place by 1980, and then the trends towards people being polarized and towards the parties being more bitterly partisan because they reflected the polarization of Americans in general and basically chose up sides between the women's rights movement and the pro-family movement, that is really what fueled our politics and led to modern politics as we know it.
Mm-hmm. And so the issues then that were dividing people were what? The abortion issue, the issue of what women's role in society should be? What were the issues?
Well, it started out with the Equal Rights Amendment. But even more than that, conservative women who were deeply invested in traditional gender roles were upset that in the early 70s, the women's movement was making so much progress in getting the government to revise laws and policies. It was an amazing period in which both Republicans and Democrats were backing feminist goals, all three branches of the federal government, and they watched this with alarm. But what really got them organized was when Congress adopted the Equal Rights Amendment without some of the modifications proposed by people like Sam Ervin to guarantee certain traditional protections. And so they mobilized behind the leadership of Phyllis Schlafly to try to block it, even after it had passed Congress overwhelmingly. And so it started out focusing on that issue in particular. And it, the anti-ERA movement remained pretty much a single-issue movement for quite a while. Meanwhile, the pro-life movement was beginning, also trying to remain a single-issue movement in order to attract as broad a group of followers as possible. And what ends up happening is, as I argue in the book, this amazing, unique event in American history occurred, which was the International Women's Year Conferences that took place in 1977. And I argue that these conferences that were sponsored by the federal government in order to give women of the nation opportunity to advise the government on future federal policy ended up being profoundly polarizing events in which women who leaned towards the feminist movement ended up siding together behind a list of 26 planks called the National Plan of Action, and conservative women who leaned towards conservative position on several different issues ended up becoming allies, particularly the anti-ERA movement and the pro-life movement, which had major implications.
Mm-hmm. And those groups have stayed polarized, and those positions have stayed with us in many ways since the 1970s. What's changed? What hasn't?
Well, what happened was that in just a few years after this conference, the Republican Party decided to choose upsides with the pro-family movement and dropping its 40-year record of support for the Equal Rights Amendment. It chose to pitch itself as the party that was the defender of traditional family values. And after that, the two parties became very different, particularly on the social issues. They'd already had differences over economic policies and foreign policy. But when this happened, it changed it, because when you are the issues that are at the forefront of national events tend to be issues that are loaded with moral and religious significance. The impact is that people tend to demonize their opponents, not just argue with them, and that compromise is very difficult to come by. Moderation starts to be viewed not so much as a political virtue, but a vice. And people on both sides of these issues, including abortion issues, gay rights issues, and others, are not willing to tolerate compromise.
Mm-hmm. Is it because those issues are hard issues on which to have any degree of moderation? They're kind of polarizing issues right off the get-go?
Yes, I think so. It's people tend to feel that it's all right or all wrong. For example, when Gerald Ford tried to take what he called a moderate position on the abortion issue, Nellie Gray, the leader of the March for Life, said, how do you take a moderate position on murdering a human being? Mm-hmm. And it's generally, some would say that there are moderate positions to be had, such as the Clintons in the 90s saying abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. For the most part, people tend to see it as something you can't compromise about. Just take, for instance, this past week when Senator Bernie Sanders and DNC leader Tom Perez,
yes,
went on the so-called unity tour.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, one of the things that kind of undermined the success of that was when they were sympathetic to a mayoral candidate who was a Democrat but pro-life. Because pretty much from the early 90s on, if you are going to be a candidate in the Democratic Party and be successful, particularly at the presidential level, you had to take a pro-choice position. And so, you know, that proved to be something that many Democrats, many people in the Democratic base, which, you know, a large part of that is passionate women's rights defenders, just said, what do you mean? You can't be bargaining that away. And that you can't say that economic rights, economic issues don't have anything to do with reproductive rights.
Mm-hmm. So is it, so we're seeing divisions certainly among people in different factions of the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party, as you've just outlined as well. Are we learning from this that there are certain issues that are sacrosanct if you're a member of the Democratic Party, the left part of the party, perhaps, if that's fair to say that? And if you take a view that might be, you're good on economic issues, you may not be good on the abortion issue. So some would say you're taking a more moderate view of where the party would be. Is that a way to lessen polarization? The Republicans have the same thing when it comes to health care reform in this country. They're divided on that issue.
Well, not quite sure how to answer your question, but I think that, as I was saying, a lot of feminists believe that the ability to be able to control when you give birth and when you are going to be engaged in, you know, the time-consuming acts of caring for young children and all, that these are profoundly affect their ability to work. Mm-hmm. and so that you can't separate those issues, whereas Senator Sanders, I believe, was suggesting that the party had to make room for people with different points of view on that issue, and that it was more important to have unity around economic policies,
right,
that benefited the working class and the middle class than it was to be ideologically pure on the reproductive rights issue. And so it's very, you know, it's very complicated. And meanwhile, the Republicans, it's been a very long time since you saw a Republican who would defend the pro-choice position, although it wasn't until 1980 that there was such a clear identification of one party with on one side and one party on the other. I mean, in the early 70s, you had, for example, you know, large numbers of Catholics tended to be Democrats, and many very prominent Democratic politicians, such as Sergeant Shriver, were firmly identified with the anti-abortion position. And then you had some giants of the Republican Party, such as Barry Goldwater, who were pro-choice. And so in 76, the first presidential election after the Roe v. Wade decision, there were Catholic leaders that were pressuring Ford to take a strong pro-life position. Ford kept insisting that he would enforce Roe as it was the law of the land, regardless of his personal positions. And then, you know, you have Jimmy Carter, who's running against him, who was saying that he personally opposes abortion. And Carter was very much criticized by feminists for that, but got strong support from social conservatives and religious conservatives, particularly in the South. But by 1980, it was a whole different ballgame, in which Reagan, who had firmly allied himself with the growing religious right, which, by the way, I trace back to this fight in 1977. It's another subject if you want to go there. And he was one of those who saw that the power of gender issues to mobilize and unite conservatives. And so, therefore, the Republican Party went along with what Phyllis Schlafly had been recommending for some time, which was to cast itself as the defender of the of life and of the unborn children. And they adopted a resolution in their platform for the first time calling for a human rights amendment to the Constitution and saying that a pro-life position would, was a litmus test in the appointment of, mm-hmm. Of any judges.
Margaret sends this email for you. She's wondering how independent numbers have changed over time. She says, I'm what would be labeled conservative on some issues and progressive on others and don't feel an affinity to either party. For example, can a pro-life Democrat or a gay Republican find a spot anymore in their parties?
Well, independents generally have, well, you find people, you know, who are independent for all kinds of reasons, so it's kind of hard to answer. But support for the Roe v. Wade seems to be very high among independents, as I understand it.
And what about gay Republicans? Is there a home in the Republican Party?
That's something that log cabin Republicans are very much hoping that there is and trying to exercise influence. It's really one of the most remarkable things about this past election, particularly around the time of the conventions, was that while Trump totally embraced the pro-family movement, the Christian rights platform when it comes to the social issues, and by the way, he had promised Schlafly and he would do that in order to get her endorsement, the one issue on which he really rather boldly defied them during the Republican convention was on the issue of gay rights. And as you recall, he had a pro-gay gay rights speaker, and he himself, you know, pledged that he was going to be supportive. And but then he seems to have kind of backed away from that. And so I think that people in the Republican Party, gay rights supporters, are troubled about that, wondering, well, what's he going to do here? Mm-hmm. Is he going to honor what he said before the public at that convention or not?
Mm-hmm. Marjorie Spruill teaches courses in women's history, Southern history, and recent American history at the University of South Carolina, author of Divided We Stand, The Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics, and she has written several other things as well. She said, we can't look at polarization in American politics and social policies without appreciating the events that divided American women in the 1970s. We're going to carry on. Mark Schmidt is joining us, director of political reform program at New America. He's got an interesting political past and has written extensively on political polarization now. And we'll welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. It's well believed that the level of political polarization is as high as it has ever been, at least in recent history. Why is that? Why has the center gotten much smaller? And maybe that's a good thing for the center to be smaller. The people should be on the right or the left. It is true that those who are really committed to one side or the other have made their voices heard through greater participation in many parts of the political process, in terms of voting, certainly, and in terms of giving money to parties. Compromise, is it a worthy thing? We'll ask our guests that as we continue and take your phone calls as well. This is the Ideas Network. We have a new guest now, Mark Schmidt, and Mark is director of the Political Reform Program at New America. It was launched to develop new approaches to understanding and reforming the market for political power. He, for a number of years, executive director, editor of the American Prospect, and he was a speechwriter and later policy director for Senator Bill Bradley. He worked on issues including welfare reform, higher education, urban policy, served as a senior advisor on Bradley's 2000 presidential campaign. He has written written about politics extensively for the New Republic, Time, and a number of other publications, the Washington Monthly, Financial Times, New York Times, and the list goes on. And we'll welcome phone calls for him as well. And thank you very much, Mark, for being with us. Hi.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you. Glad to be here.
Very nice to meet you. Democrats and liberals, you have written, can't make polarization go away. For decades, there were Republicans from the North, the Midwest, the West Coast, and even the South who were more liberal than many Democrats, and Democrats from the South who were more conservative than many Republicans. So what happened? What happened after that?
Well, I think some trends just take a long time to sort out. And after the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of 1964 and 65, you had a tendency of, it took a while, but over time, starting with Southern whites, moved from being very, very solid Democrats who, you know, for deep multi-generational reasons, switched over, starting, as your previous guest said, starting with Goldwater and Nixon towards being very solid Republicans. And that's not changing. And African Americans in the South moved in the other direction. The other change that you saw, which doesn't get as much appreciation, is that there were kind of liberal areas, particularly suburbs. Thinking of areas like the suburbs around Philadelphia, Chicago, suburban part of Connecticut that's close to New York, that had historically been Republican. They were relatively wealthy. They'd been sort of WASPy, but liberal voters there tended to be pro-choice, socially liberal, and they moved really starting in the 70s, around 1974, with the reaction to President Nixon. They began to move in the direction of the Democratic Party, but it took a long time. It actually took a matter of decades for that sorting out to happen. We often think, well, there was a wonderful era where there were a lot of conservative Republicans and a lot of conservative Democrats and a fair number of liberal Republicans. That's the era, in fact, when I worked on Capitol Hill, and you'd see people on both sides, and so you could create different kinds of coalitions around different issues, where you'd often have, my boss would often have three or four strong allies on the Republican side, and three or four people on the Democratic side who were opposed to what he was trying to do. That happened a lot. It kind of created some fluidity. But that's not the way things are supposed to be. It was just a kind of historical accident, really.
Mm-hmm. When you talked about and have written about President Obama's to have this new kind of collaborative politics, it was interesting what he did, that this whole health care reform, and you remind us that he based it on a Republican plan. He really wanted consensus on this. He worked for a bipartisan health reform bill, and it finally happened with not any Republican support, but he had tried to do this, is this fair to say, kind of a bipartisan approach to things, and he got the bill, but this bipartisan thing didn't work out very well.
That's right. Ultimately, he had to find a way to do it with just Democratic support. Now, I think he still approached it in the right way, because I think it was important for some Democrats to see that he'd at least made the effort to work as hard with Republicans. I think he encouraged a period of about, I think it was as long as 8 or 9 months, during which he was encouraging the two leaders of the Senate Finance Committee, which is the key committee for health care, to find some common ground. That was Senator Baucus from Montana and Senator Grassley from Iowa. And, you know, really, really encouraged them to keep talking. And they couldn't find common ground, or, you know, the Republican opposition to just about everything was so strong. But it took a while to really see that. But I think Obama had a real deep belief that he could restore some of that habit of that conversation, even knowing that there weren't necessarily Republicans who were more liberal, but by treating conservative ideas really seriously and trying to find some common ground between conservative ideas about health care and liberal ideas about health care, which he actually did, I think he hoped he could move forward that way, and I think that's one of the great disappointments of the Obama years. Mm.
And some would say that Donald Trump is doing somewhat the same thing, trying to combine some conservative ideas and perhaps some liberal ideas. Is he?
I don't see that. I think there was a possibility that he could have done that. I think that's been kind of cut off now. I mean, there's occasional talk about I'll work with Democrats on infrastructure, but we haven't really seen that. And then the full expression of his policy proposals is often as close to kind of the wish list of the farthest extreme as you could imagine. That's the case with the tax proposal today, which includes a very, very modest tax cut for for average families in the form of increasing the standard deduction, and then it started at about $2 trillion. It's more when you look at everything that's in that proposal of cuts for corporate level business owners, top rates, and so forth. So it's pretty dramatic change. Same with the budget he proposed, which goes way beyond what either Republicans or Democrats are willing to support in terms of their cuts to all kinds of basic programs. So I think there was some talk about that, and I think there's still some people who expect that this sort of unusual combination where you do have a more supportive government, but you're also connecting conservative ideas, might happen, but the effort really hasn't been there. And I don't know whether that's not kind of knowing enough about where people stand, or that it was all just a head fake to begin with.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some greats of the past, creative presidents who were able to move pieces around, you write, to create success in many ways. You mentioned LBJ, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, creative legislators, Lloyd Benson, Henry Waxman. It's hard to think of people right now who are serving who will be able to move things around to create success, because everything is, people are just at each other. The Pew Research Center, I'm sure you saw this not that long ago, did this very extensive study and found one of their findings was that the most ideologically oriented are really making their voices heard now through greater participation and important participation. Their voting rates are much higher than those on the right or the left, higher among those on the left than in the middle. Political donation rates are double the national average among those who are ideologically consistent liberals and also conservatives. If that's the way you get nominated, if that's the way you get to win office, no wonder we have such partisanship, right? If the most ideological are are playing the game here, are outlining the rules for the game. Would you agree with that? And how does that get changed so that people, of all stripes, of all kinds of ideologies, can be in the game?
Right. I mean, there's a fascinating question about whether the people who are representing us in Congress, in state governments, like as in Wisconsin, are they potentially more polarized than people are? The average people don't necessarily have strong, unyielding ideological commitments. Some do on one or two issues. Some do across the board, but most people generally don't. That is true, although the people, as you say, the people who are most active and make their voices heard often do tend to have that stronger commitment. And, of course, the parties aren't exactly the same on this either. The Republican Party does tend to be a tighter tighter ideological coherence from its representatives. But I think it's going to be hard to recreate some of the fluidity that we saw without some structure that allows either alternative parties or other voices to get into the mix and challenge both, so that the challenges don't just come from the left or the right of one's own party, but might come from the center and from voters who have a different viewpoint altogether.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think that will ever happen?
I think you can begin to see some experiments with ideas like that. It requires some real rule changes to make it work. So, for example, in Maine, Maine has a very polarized system, very conservative governor who didn't win a majority of the vote either in his first or second election, because there's a big, there's a strong tradition of independent candidates in Maine, such as their current Senator Angus King. The problem was that the independent candidate for governor in the last two elections got just enough of the vote to hold the Democrat down and allow Governor LePage to take office. But in Maine last year, they adopted a system called ranked choice voting, which would allow voters to say, you know, here's my first choice for governor, here's my second choice for governor, and that would allow the winner to at least have some evidence of a broader base of support. The winner might be the independent. Everybody might be fine with the independent, and the independent might move up. Everybody might be more people might be okay with the Democrat, or of the people who voted for the independent, let's say more of them might be okay with the Democrat. That becomes their second choice, and then that person might move up. So systems like that, or systems where, for example, a party might be able to sometimes run its own candidates and sometimes endorse another party's candidates, which is what they are able to do in New York, for example. Mm-hmm. Things like that might add some, what I refer to as kind of fluidity in the system, so that everything doesn't just fall in lockstep along these two-party lines.
Yeah, it's interesting. Find out what our audience thinks about that. Mark Schmidt is our guest this part of the program, director of the Program on Political Reform at New America. He writes extensively about politics, and he worked with Senator Bill Bradley when he was a senator, and also for his presidential campaign back in the year 2000. Polarization, a lot has been said about it. We are a very polarized society. As a matter of fact, we even choose to live in different areas. According to the Pew Research survey that was done just a little while ago, that more liberals prefer smaller houses close to amenities, and more conservatives want to be in a community where the houses are farther apart and where many in the community share their religious faith. But you can hear it. You know, you get together for a gathering, and if you have people of different political persuasions, you can sense the political divide in the country pretty easily. How extensive is it? What do we do about it? Why do we have it? The questions of this hour, and we're welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. I want to remind you that there's a special forum this coming Saturday. I'll be moderating this, Bridging the Polarization Divide. It's at the Whitefish Bay Public Library. It is sponsored by the League of Women Voters and Wisconsin Public Radio. A great panel. Tim Cullen and Dale Schultz will be with us, one of former Democratic Senate Majority Leader, one former Republican Senate Majority Leader, and they are together now, traveling the state, writing books, talking extensively about bipartisanship, and they are particularly concerned about gerrymandering. There also will be Professor Lily Gorin, political science professor at Carroll University, the associate editorial page editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel will also be there, and somebody who will specialize conversation on media and changing minds or changing channels, partisan news in an age of choice. We'll ask our guest about that as well. It's open to the public, and it's going to be this Saturday. Aaron Richards, who is from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, will co-moderate with me. It should be a great morning, and you are invited. All right, to you momentarily on the Ideas Network. First caller for you is Daryl in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for allowing me on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have a comment. I believe we are in this bad situation because we, as a culture and a country, have misplaced our faith in ourselves. And the proof of this is in the fact that all media, educators, and especially politicians, refer to politicians, the president, the military, and others as the government, when actually they are all bureaucrats and part of bureaucracies. If you consider the preamble to the Constitution, actually the first three words, we the people, that is the only government there ever was or will be. But we as a country and citizens have been programmed that we are not the government. And that works because we have been programmed to believe this. So, hence, we accept this because we have lost our faith in ourselves and our country.
How does that make us polarized, Daryl?
Well, if you got some people confused that you know, they're not going to go vote, they're not going to do anything, they're not going to participate at all.
Yeah, why is it so many people don't vote? Mark?
Well, I think, you know, for one thing, we create obstacles to voting. We create entirely unnecessary obstacles to voting. I mean, it used to be if you took a test to become an American citizen, to naturalize as an American citizen, one of the questions they would ask is, what's the most important right that American citizens have? And the correct answer, if you wanted to pass, was the right to vote. And yet, it's the only right that we require people to register before they're allowed to exercise. We don't require you to register in order to exercise your right to free speech or religion. That's an entirely unnecessary obstacle, and that's even before you get to issues like voter ID or the purging of people from voter rolls. So that's a big part of it. It's a non-trivial part of it, but people also hear a lot of messages that say government doesn't respond to you, government doesn't listen to you, government is an other rather than you. And government, you know, we all have, our vote is small. Our vote alone won't make a big difference, but it's the only way we can make our voice heard in democracy.
Right.
But people are told over and over again that won't work again. So I really do agree with the caller about that.
Yeah, thanks, Daryl, for your call. Todd in Appleton. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about something a little bit outside the box here, and I've noticed this over the years. I'm a senior citizen, but I get to talk to lots of people from different age groups. Since the arrival of social media, there's been a lot of people who of like opinion who find it very easy to cloister kind of in their own little corner
right.
of like opinion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you try to enter one of those conversations, you're considered, I guess the term is troll, and or interrupting. They don't want to hear you. And they are also, it's difficult because of that, I think, that for people to communicate with each other in person and have a civil conversation. It used to be that people of opposite opinion, you kind of mellowed out when you're face-to-face in the same room. And even if you disagreed and walked away disagreeing, you still had a discussion. I don't see a lot of that, and I'm not blaming the technology. Social media has kind of, like, given rise to this polarization because people could just sit there in their little, like I said, in their little corners of like opinion and not have to listen to anyone else.
I think you have a good point, Mark. What do you think?
Yeah, there's no question that it's much, much easier to kind of live in your own bubble if you choose to, and actually hard to make the effort to get out of it. And part of what that bubble does, very often, if your bubble is Fox News or Breitbart, and if your bubble is some outlets on the left as well, is kind of tell you what the other side thinks
mm-hmm.
in a way that you're not hearing, you know, rather than actually listening to ordinary people who hold different views, you're kind of hearing those views characterized for you, and then when you're actually face-to-face, it takes a long time to realize maybe they're not coming from where you thought they were coming from, and that's true across the board. And, I don't think it's a matter of just sort of stop and do something different. I think it's going to take real work for people to do that. And we're not used to doing that work because we used to find ourselves in conversations, in comfortable conversations and experiences with people who were different, who had different views all the time. I mean, one of the interesting things about the decline of unions, for example, people will often treat unions as if they're just an economic force or maybe just a progressive force. But unions brought people together in a room with people who had very different views from their own, and they shared an identity as workers at a particular industry or in a particular plant. But beyond that, they actually would talk to each other and see different views. That's one of a lot of the sort of civil society institutions that have fallen away made those conversations possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go beyond social media for a moment. Let's go to what's happened with cable news, what's happened with radio shows, too. Talk shows have been dominated by, at least on the AM dial, conservative radio hosts, people like Rush Limbaugh, for years and years now. And the most popular network, cable, is still Fox News. I don't know, with all their turmoil, what'll be the case a few months from now. But that has a decidedly, all of those outlets have one point of view. Others will say that the mainstream press New York Times, Washington Post is a decidedly liberal point of view. But I'm wondering what role that plays, what role people who listen to people like Rush Limbaugh, listen to him every day, and you hear some of the same opinions, and views are even reinforced. Even the president said, I don't know if it's true or not, that he's only watching Fox News because he gets too mad when he watches CNN. First of all, well, you can go in many directions here. There's kind of a lack of in-depth reporting on the part of networks as to what's going on all over the world. You've got all these talking heads who are screaming at each other sometimes, and you think, what's the point? Can't we learn something from all of this? But what role does that play in our being kind of mad at each other, polarized?
Yeah, I think...
Are you there, Mark? Hello? Oh, we lost the... Hello, Mark. No, oh, he was in the middle of... We lost him, so we'll need to call him back. And we want you to call us as well, too. We're talking about polarization in this country and why it seems to be so pronounced, why we don't have people in office who are talking to people on the other side of the aisle and trying to fashion legislation where there are compromises. What were some of the great compromises? What about some of the issues of the day that no matter what your ideology, you think action should be taken immediately? Do we tend to center on those issues that are more divisive? Are there other kinds of issues where we can come to some kind of agreement? We will talk about that, and our guest reminds us of what's happening with incarceration. It's become so expensive that people are looking for alternatives to large numbers of people being incarcerated. We will discuss that as well. As listen to you, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. And while we try to connect with Mark, Mark has an interesting background. He is now director of the Program on Political Reform at New America, which is a policy research organization. He's written extensively about politics, and he's been involved in politics as well. He worked with Senator Bill Bradley when he was in the Senate, and also was his manager when he ran for president back in 2000. So we're trying to reconnect with him. In the meantime, we can take some phone calls here. 800-486-8655. Hello. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I think that my comment is I think that our founders did not foresee a society to grow as large and as diverse as it is. And I think the problem lies that it kind of needs a new framework. It's we're so much larger and much more vast and culturally diverse. And, I mean, we're so interconnected, and it's maybe a reset button if there was one. I don't know.
And how would you reset it?
I honestly, in a most peaceful way, I really couldn't tell you in a very peaceful way. I'm not saying a revolution, but, you know, two people can't sit in the same room with each other nowadays and have a political discussion.
Yeah, you know? I think it's very hard these days. I think you're right. What happens to you when you're in a room with somebody who completely disagrees with you, whatever your politics happen to be?
Well, that would be my in-laws. They're a very, very far right-wing conservative, and I have no problem with right-wing. I think there needs to be a balance between left and right-wing politics. That's why it's, you know, called a democracy and a republic all kind of at the same time. But I just let people, you know, have their opinion long as they don't become bigoted. If they become bigoted, I'm not afraid to share what, you know, what I think the truth is about bigotry.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Right. That's me. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. And we are trying to reconnect with our guest, Mark Schmidt. The phone just kind of dropped off, so we'll try and reach him again and find out his further thoughts about this. He also said, let me find the part of the writing, because it'd be interesting for you to respond to this as well. He reminds us of times when people from different viewpoints were able to get together, and they were either very good at what they did or there was not an era of excessive partisanship. But he says that we need to, in order to find middle ground, that we need to build institutions and strategies that are appropriate to this new alignment that we have, the new alignment, which is no longer when there were Republicans from the North and the Midwest and the West Coast and even the border South who are more liberal than many Democrats, and Democrats, especially from the South, who are more conservative than many Republicans. And so we have Mark with us again. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
I don't know what happened. You just kind of dropped off. And I can't.
Okay.
I've been.
I thought I was there, but.
I thought you were, too, but I can't remember what you were saying. We got two words, and then you were gone, but I can't remember what your two words were.
The question was about talk radio,
I think. It was up, yeah, talk radio and cable news.
And cable news.
Right.
Which are two different things. I mean, talk radio has been around for a long, long time. Rush Limbaugh's been around since the. Since the 80s, I think, if not even earlier than that. And I think it's always been a habit that there's a kind of entertainment factor in getting angry and getting fired up, but then it really does have long-term consequences. The cable news is a largely a more recent phenomenon, and then you have the even narrower elements where you have web publications, for example, that people are immersed in those worlds that are going even further, and worse, they're sort of invisible to other people. Like, I generally know what's on Fox News. I have, a rough idea sometimes of what Rush Limbaugh is talking about, but I don't generally know what's in Breitbart or Newsmax or some of these other sources of information that circulate. And that's just because I don't live in that world, and other people don't necessarily know what the sources on the more on the left wing or progressive side.
So, are you suggesting that we all live in those worlds? That we live in all worlds if we can? I mean, not in Breitbart necessarily.
I think it's important to, as a citizen, and it's work, and people have a lot of things going on in their life, so it's a lot to expect. But I think part of the work of being a citizen is probably to occasionally turn on something you don't usually watch or listen to, or to look at something on the internet that's a little different. I like, for example, the New York Times has started publishing what they call partisan writing. So it's they'll republish things that they call from the right and left, and people get a sense of what other people are saying. But it is hard work. I mean, for me, it always used to be a matter of make sure you're reading the Wall Street Journal editorial page, make sure you're looking at Fox occasionally. There's so many different outlets now. On the one hand, we seem like we're polarized in two boxes. At the same time, there's so many different sources of information within those two boxes that it can be hard to recognize the other things that are out there.
Yeah. Ed is calling from Woodruff next. Hi, Ed.
Yes, I was wondering what you thought about restoring the fairness doctrine, where two people's issues thoughts would be brought up on these issues, and I'll take my answer off there.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of restoring the fairness doctrine. I also don't think it's anything that's going to happen. I think it actually, in an era when there were a broadcast license was a valuable thing, and there was really no other way to communicate by radio and television, and there were three television networks, I think there might have been something to be said for saying, in exchange for a license to use this scarce public resource, which is the airwaves, you have an obligation to present a variety of views on the issues. I think in the world we live in, where there are hundreds of cable channels and hundreds of internet outlets, I don't think that it's reasonable to require any single one to present a variety of viewpoints beyond what they want to present themselves. And I think that, and the fairness doctrine has been gone for decades and decades now. So I think it is, unfortunately, it is more incumbent on citizens to try to find somewhat of a range of viewpoints, and I don't think we can require it from broadcasters.
Mm. And let's just get the comment from Jake. We're almost out of time. Hi, Jake.
Yeah, just real quick, two things. One thing I've noticed is the red versus blue, Republican versus Democrat, the sort of tribalism. It's a lot more against each other than with each other. And then additionally, a big thing here in Eau Claire that the community engagement's been working on, is they call them one-to-ones. And that's where you just go get coffee with someone for 45 minutes and just deeply talk to the person, find out what they're all about in order to find out where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't know someone, then you're not going to understand their argument fully.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. Thank you very much. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. I'm sorry we lost you for a while, but glad
thank
we reconnected.
You very much.
Thank you. And a reminder, the League of Women Voters is having a forum this coming Saturday, Bridging the Polarization Divide, Wisconsin Public Radio is also helping to sponsor this event. I will be moderating it, and there will be a number of interesting people addressing polarization on a panel. It's at the Whitefish Bay Library. It starts at 10 o'clock this coming Saturday. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour, and thanks to Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be with you again tomorrow. We'll be talking about people are doing wonderfully good things in Milwaukee this hour of the show tomorrow. Hope you'll listen.